Okay, so I want to start by kind of sketching a little bit the big picture of the various subjects that I want to discuss about in these lectures. And we'll be connecting various kind of parts of physics and mathematics, and it's also for me to a large extent the motivation to study the more mathematical things that we have been hearing about and still hearing about in this our math physics workshop. So the starting point for me is very much n equals 1 supersymmetric gate series . There are various good arguments to study these objects, but one thing which is very nice of it is that actually supersymmetric gate series, as we have now know for a long time, allow very powerful methods to analyze them. And as was kind of stressed, I guess, very much by Natti Seiberg, there's this kind of concept of holomorphy. Just the statement that there are various kind of holomorphic objects naturally appearing in supersymmetric gate theory in particular, and that we'll be talking about, so-called F-terms, which are integrals in terms of superspace. This is, I will explain all this, which are integrals over two of the four supersymmetric variables. And the important thing is that these are holomorphic fields of the variables that appear. So there's a natural context of all these holomorphic objects. F-terms are definitely not capturing the full gate theory, but they capture, to a large extent, the infrared dynamics, that is, the vacuum structure. And so they encode very important physical information. Now, one thing we have learned, basically, I think, from starting with the work of Seiberg and Witten, is that to understand these theories, which are very difficult because you have to understand them at strong coupling, that this strong coupling dynamics somehow magically is encoded by a geometry. So there's an so-called effective geometry appearing here. And in the case of Seiberg and Witten, this was a Riemann surface. And in many cases, I will be discussing their Riemann surfaces. But I think kind of the modern point of view is that more general, these should be thought of as Calabi-Yau threefolds. In fact, more precisely, topological strings on these Calabi-Yau threefolds. So you somehow learn that just in terms of using these holomorphic techniques, that somehow lurking in this four-dimensional gate theory is a Calabi-Yau threefold that captures very important information. And of course, in string theory, we can work the other way around, because we can now use that Calabi-Yau to compactify strings. So strings allow you to go back and to use this kind of 10-dimensional geometry to engineer the four-dimensional gate theory. But it's quite a mysterious connection. So one of the few things I want to explain about this is that there is some way to go another way, and namely go through old-fashioned perturbation theory. So actually do Feynman supergraphs. To capture these gate theories, and then make crucially use of the fact that within n equals 1 gate theory, there's an object called the chiral ring, which essentially does not depend on the four space-time dimensions you start with. So in some sense, you reduce from, so here we have d equals 4, in some sense you reduce to d equals 0. And then the important ingredient is that these perturbative computations combined with holomorphy, the thing that should be holomorphic, so there is some kind of issue here of analyticity. It tells you that these perturbative series have very nice convergence properties. And actually, that allows you to, at least in many cases, to write things in terms of a matrix model. So there's a way to engineer essentially a matrix model out of this perturbative series. In particular, we will find that in certain cases, a specific term here will correspond to Feynman diagrams if they have a large N representation of specific topology. So here, it's basically the issue of planar diagrams that allows you to map the Feynman diagram computations to a matrix model. And then when you're here, you can use large N techniques to, out of the matrix model, reconstruct the geometry. So here, in some sense, the geometry appears as the master field. So the Calabi-Yau is like the master field summing these large N diagrams. Now this is one route. There's another way. In some sense, you can go straight here using anomalies. And I will also say something about that. So there's some very strange kind of, I call it like a bootstrap method. You can go from supersymmetric gate theories through Feynman diagrams to matrix models to holomorphic geometry, Calabi-Yau threefold geometry, and then go back to the gate theory. So it points to two things, I think, the importance of this Calabi-Yau threefolds, and also I want to stress the importance of the matrix models. Now, matrix models appeared at other places in string theory. And so the second subject I want to talk about is that there's a direct connection between matrix models, kind of using double scaling limits. With so-called non-critical strings. Actually, possibly superstrings. And using all these dictionaries, actually this double scaling limit and everything that goes along with it, we can completely mimic here in the geometry. So there will be a very nice understanding of these scaling limits directly in terms of singular Calabi-Yau geometry. So there's a, in some sense, a direct connection also along these lines that I want to explore further. And basically, we'll make the statement that all the multiple strings know, because either in this way, using Calabi-Yau strings. In fact, when these non-critical strings appeared, like 10 years ago, there was a lot of interest in the fact that these are exactly solvable. So these are exactly solvable in many cases. So they're integrable. And there's a very powerful these non-critical strings and integral are. Yes? Sorry? Oh, sorry. So there's a very strong connection between this and integrable hierarchies. In fact, if you look at these solutions, these are all kind of in terms of free fermions. And I think the developments in the last half year are pointing out to kind of, I would say, somehow the missing link in this picture. So you can ask, what has this integrable structure to do with this geometry? And one thing I want to present at the end of my lecture, actually, that there's a very natural link between this whole integrability and, again, studying strings and Calabi-Yau threefolds, namely, if you include brains. So brains are somehow will be the very strong link between here and here. And I think, so I'm still kind of struggling, what is the kind of central object here? But I would say there's something which is like, I would like to call a quantum Calabi-Yau manifold that seems to kind of capture this whole structure. So there are lots of kind of links between the various ways. And to give you kind of part of the punchline, one of the things that we will see, if the Calabi-Yau is given by some algebraic variety that I'm just very sloppily writing as some function h equal to 0, we'll see that if you put brains in the Calabi-Yau and worked in all orders in G string, which you want to think of as H bar, that this corresponds to kind of solving the Schrödinger operator, H psi equals 0. So at the end, I want to kind of demonstrate in a large class of examples that there is such a thing as a quantum Calabi-Yau, which is essentially is replaces the geometry that we know by kind of a non-commutative geometry. In the sense we have, for instance, two variables x and y, and we will have a kind of canonical commutation relations that turns the geometry essentially into an operator, and then you can solve the spectrum of the operator. For instance, doing this will give the Lex operators that naturally appear here in the integrable hierarchies. It allows us to write correlation functions of these D-brains. In fact, it allows us to write matrix models for them, So there's actually also a link from studying brains in these string theory and matrix models. And this is a matrix model, for those of you who are familiar with that, which is of the so-called Kontsevich type. So Kontsevich matrix models naturally appear studying a collection of brains on a geometry. And so, there are enough arrows on this blackboard. So everything is connected to everything. But so in some sense, I have to kind of start somewhere. So why not start at the upper left corner? So I will start today studying some, making some, basically some elementary stuff about supersymmetric gate theories. Then study the simplest case, linking it to a matrix model. So this is in some sense, perhaps for some of you, certainly for me, kind of old stuff. But I still want to go through the motion, at least to have the simplest example and get good definitions of everything. But you should really have in your back of your mind that in the end we want to kind of attempt some kind of grandiose generalization, connecting everything. So are there any questions about this point, just about the general philosophy here? Okay. So I want to start just studying, say some things about gate theories.
Robert,
yes. Well, okay, so this is only, we work kind of example by example, right? So up to now, everything that we somehow were able to engineer in this way were Calabi-Yau threefolds, and somehow the justification, of course, is that there is such a thing as topological strings, actually to be precise, of B-type, which means that you really need a Calabi-Yau condition here. So I won't even, but I think in some sense, certainly from a mathematical perspective, we know that all these things also make sense for, say, which would, so if you wouldn't have the Calabi-Yau condition, wouldn't be conformal, you would have massive sigma models. But, say, in the mathematical context, all this works through. For instance, actually, it's easier in some sense. Like these studying topological strings on these using massive sigma models, you can actually kind of, some sense, factorize that in terms of kind of trivial models. And the exact solutions are known. So I think there's a part of the story certainly generalized. I don't know how to, and also for some of them, matrix models have been written down. So it could very well be that that extends beyond Calabi-Yau. Part of it, the story definitely does. For instance, these integrable hierarchies are still there and everything. People looked at that.
Well, yes? Can you just explain a quick thing about what part of the diagram you've drawn is essentially topological in nature and where there might be?
Everything, I think, in some sense.
Well,
there are D terms everywhere, of course. And a lot of this is, so a very important question, of course, to which extent this does really capture the gate series, as it does for n equals 2, for instance. And so the most ambitious statement is that, but I'm not sure even if it has a chance of standing, is that if you do the same thing for, so most of this will be about massive n equals 1 theories. If you do it for conformal n equals 1 theories, which I think is basically unexplored territory, at least there, so you would be super conformal field theories. There you might have a chance that they fix much more. For instance, in two dimensions, we know that super conformal field theories, F data fixes everything. So somehow the fact that you have a fixed point fixes the D terms in that case. So I'm not quite sure, but I mean, one possible option could be that something similar works in four dimensions. So the infrared fixed points are classified by this story, and then somehow there's some uniqueness theorem that tells you that there are corresponding D terms. So that means that any theory should somehow be seen as a perturbation of a conformal fixed point. I think that's the best thing to do. There are other little hints. For instance, there's a lot of, we know that there is a very intricate holomorphic and anti-holomorphic structure hidden in some of these things, the so-called holomorphic anomaly. Nobody really has given a good explanation whether that has anything to do with similar questions about anti-holomorphic dependence in the gate series. But I think that's still open. Yes. Okay, so I want to start with writing down some, because I will use all these concepts, so say some things about just supersymmetry in four dimensions. So we have D equals 4, N equals 1 supersymmetry, which means that we have the supersymmetry algebra, which I write as Q alpha, Q beta dot equals, well, gamma mu alpha beta dot p mu, which is p alpha beta dot. And alpha and beta dot are spinner indices. So these are the two indices. And the usual way to look at these supersymmetric gauge theories in terms of superspace. So we have a superspace which are labeled by four bosonic coordinates, two fermionics and two other anti-chiral fermionic coordinates. And then you write essentially vector fields on the superspace that implement this algebra. Well, I'm not going through all of this, but important thing is that Q alpha is the usual, it's a linear operator. And then there's this Ex alpha beta dot. And there's a corresponding kind of covariant derivative that commutes with Q, so similar relation for Q bar. And then there are the covariant derivatives, spinner derivatives, which are of the following type. Now, most of the supersymmetry we are going to use, we use either the Qs or the Q bars. So we can simplify our life a little bit by writing this d alpha, by observing that it's actually just conjugate with some function with respect to the usual spinner derivative, d alpha, where u is this vector field, 1/2 theta alpha, theta bar beta dot, d alpha beta dot. So in many instances, I work with some gauge that I multiply my fields by e to the u or plus or minus e to the u to simplify all the covariant derivatives. In particular, I often work with a gauge where d bar alpha dot is just the dd theta bar alpha dot. So it's a very simple gauge. And then the statement is that if you work in the superspace, in this n equals 1 supersymmetric theories, there's a very natural cohomology problem here. Namely, if you look, say, pick the anti of the Q bar supercharge, this actually will square to 0, so it defines a cohomology. And you can look at the cohomology of this operator Q bar, and that's by definition the chiral ring. And the chiral ring consists of operators O that satisfy, so Q bar alpha dot on O is 0, modulo Q bar exact objects. And why are they interesting? Because, well, using just the language of field theory, they are the lowest components of chiral superfields, so of some chiral superfield phi that only depends on x and theta, not on theta bar. So d bar of phi is 0. And it's these chiral multiplets that we're talking about. So these are holomorphic objects, and it's these holomorphic objects that will propagate through this whole story. And the important thing is that if you look at such an operator O, so there's a very important fact just coming out of this algebra, if you have an operator O satisfying this and you differentiate it with respect to X, then this can be written as the commutator of Q alpha dot with Q alpha and O. So this is the usual statement that space-time derivatives of operators O are Q bar exact. So this is kind of weakly to 0 in the cohomology. And that means that if you consider, if you have now a supersymmetric vacuum, so that means the state that's in particular annihilated by Q bar, then you can look at correlation functions of these chiral operators, so O1 x1 to On xn. And then you can make the important observation that is independent. Well, it's two things. It's independent of the xi's, of the positions, so it's just a number, even though it's a correlation function in quantum field theory. And it's also independent of course, the representatives of the class in the chiral ring. So it only depends if you shift O by a Q bar exact term, it will not do anything. Now, if you also, and I will come to that later, if the theory is massive, so there are no non-trivial light degrees of freedom, and the vacuum satisfies so-called cluster decomposition, then in mathematical terms, I would say you can kind of diagonalize the chiral ring. For those of you familiar with quantum cohomology of signal models, know this very well. You would say that the chiral ring is semi-simple. Here you have a similar statement in these four-dimensional gate theories. And just now the statement is that if this computes correlation function, this will be just a product of one-point functions. So this is not a property of the theory so much as a property of the particular vacuum that you picked. Right? So this is by definition the operators acting in this supersymmetric vacuum zero. So it's particularly, you have to pick a particular base of your vacua to have this factorization property. So the next ingredient we have to introduce, so we have these natural, these chiral fields. So we have chiral fields, phi. And then you want to write down a Lagrangian for these fields. And you can write two kind of terms, terms which depend on all four of the anti-commuting thetas. And you can, but in particular, you can write so-called F terms. So what is an F-term? Well, the thing I want to discuss at this moment is the superpotential, which is an integral over d squared theta d4x, some holomorphic function w that kind of depends on whatever the number of chiral fields are that we have. So part of our input will be this function w, which you think of a general kind of a general function of these chiral superfields. So we'd be very much interested in gate theories. So let me immediately kind of write down the next ingredient. So we will have a gate group G, and the fields will transform in certain representations. So in general, we have a gate group G. Phi will be in a representation, say a representation R of G. And we require that W of phi is G invariant. And so the holomorphic information of the gate theory will all encode it in this choice of W, which is kind of the what's called the tree-level superpotential. So from the gate theory perspective, our ingredient will in some sense be just a representation of this group G and an invariant function, typically polynomial. But not necessarily. I will also deal with some non-polynomial cases later. But this function W is very important. Now, another ingredient if you... So what we will do is then also introduce the gauge field. So the second ingredient is somehow the gauge field. Now, you can put a lot of time and energy describing gauge fields in terms of supergeometry. I won't do this. I will just review the bare formula. So usually what you do this is you start with some gauge potential, well, it's some super gauge potential. It's a Lie algebra valued function of x, theta, and theta bar. And you go to a whole song and dance, but the important thing is there's a notion of kind of a super field strength. So this curvature, the curvature of this kind of super, well, not really super connection, but this V. So write down the formula. So W alpha, so it's a spinner, it has two components. And in terms of V, it's written by the following identity, D bar squared E to the minus V D alpha E to the V. But the important thing to know, it's another chiral superfield. So it's chiral superfield. And it has, as its components, so W is chiral, so D bar of 0. So it plays the same role as the chiral super, the metal superfields I just introduced. And if you expand it in components, its lowest component is a spinner, and then there's a term theta beta f alpha beta. So lambda alpha is a spinner, it's called the Gugino. It's a spinner with values in the Lie algebra. And f alpha beta is the self-dual part of the usual two-form curvature. So the chiral superfield contains the self-dual part of the curvature of the connection. There's an ordinary connection there. And this is the superpartner of the connection. And the important relation you want out of the whole theory is the following identity. Namely, if you take a commutator of W alpha with any operator O, not any operator, I think I probably need a chiral operator. Yeah, a chiral operator. Then this commutator can be evaluated using the supersymmetry algebra, and it's Q bar alpha dot with the spacetime derivative, so alpha dot alpha of O. So that means in particular, this is again zero in the cohomology. So the nice thing of this super curvature is that any commutation relations with any other operator is kind of Q bar exact. And that means that's actually quite an important relation that we will use many times. For instance, it immediately tells you if you take the commutator of two of these guys, so these are Lie algebra valued objects, if you compute their anti-commutator, you find that by just taking O to be W beta, that this is kind of weakly zero. So the W is kind of anti-commute up to Q bar exact terms. So one operator I'm particularly interested in is the so-called glue ball, and then we have all the definitions almost. The glue ball superfield, which is the operator, well, there's some normalization here, which I put here. So my notation for it will be S, and it's trace of W alpha, W beta, epsilon alpha beta. So it's a quadratic expression in this W. And it appears in many ways. For instance, if you want to write a super Yang-Mills action, you write it in this, it's an F term, so it can be written as an integral d4x d2 theta tau times, 2 pi I tau times S, so plus the complex conjugate, where tau is the complexified gauge coupling, so tau is the usual thing, theta over 2 pi plus 4 pi I over g squared. So if you do gauge theories, you get this extra kind of, if you wish, superpotential, which is linear in this field S. So, we will do many things with this, but this is the basic problem, which you could just have stated in a kind of ordinary quantum field theory class. So given these chiral metal fields phi, which are in some representation of the gauge group, and the superpotential W of phi, compute, so put the theory in a gauge theory background, and compute the effect of superpotential as a function of the field S. So that's one of the problems we will answer. Lots of subtleties here. But this is just a computation. So this is just computing, if you wish, from the mathematical language. You would have some background gauge field, and you compute like the whatever, some determinant of some Dirac operator in a background connection. So this is kind of the super analog of that. So that's the one thing that we want to compute, and this is our kind of the typical kind of physical information that we will get through this kind of geometrical engineering. Sorry? So there are two parts of this question, the dynamics from the gauge field and the dynamics of the metal fields that we all have to distinguish in this question. Yes. So there's a perturbative part and a non-perturbative part. Well, so I'm actually... And again, S itself is manifestly gauge invariant, of course.
kind of discussion on the operators OI. Were they supposed to be denied or not?
Good question. Yes, I think, yeah. And at least that's what I assumed up to now, yes. And that's what I will also assume later, yes. Where? Sorry? Here?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Yes, sure. But that's actually, of course, an important condition, because if the O is not gauge invariant, for instance, yeah, so otherwise you would even find that there is no cohomology at all in the for a super Yang-Mills field, right? Because yeah, so here you need in this equivalence relation you need oh sorry, what I'm saying here.
No.
Okay. Yeah. This is actually I applied yes. Right.
Elsewhere.
Yes, yes. In the definition of the chiral ring, which is yes. 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 Well, we'll do part of this dance tomorrow. So, it'll be yeah. So, because there, I will actually just do the Feynman diagrams, and which actually I think will be quite instructive. But now, actually, I want to kind of because I want to get to the matrix model today. So I will do one example, make a statement, and then analyze the corresponding solution. So the simplest case, and this is the case that we have to keep in our minds in many things, is kind of this case of a deformed n equals 2 theory, which means that we have one field, so the group G will be UN, and the field phi will be in the adjoint. And we write a superpotential W. Well, we write a superpotential of the following type. We write a d squared theta trace W of phi, where W is a polynomial that I will parameterize in the following way. 1 over k tk phi to the k. And k will run here for me from 1 to n plus 1. So this is a polynomial of degree n plus 1. And I will also fix Tn plus 1 to be 1. So I have n moduli here, which are the variables T1 up to Tn. So everything I will compute will be a function of these n moduli to start with. And I will also make another assumption, namely that it will have isolated critical points. So if you take W prime of x of phi, which is a product of phi minus ai. Sorry, n plus 1, I want to be 1. I fix the leading coefficient. I don't want to consider that as an actual modulus. So I will have a potential which has isolated critical points. So at a1, a2, a3, etc. Which means that in the small fluctuations, you will just look like a Gaussian case, and we just have a massive scalar at each of these points. So this will be a massive quantum field theory. And so let's analyze this case. So the first step you do is to look at the classical vacua. And the classical vacua are given by the critical points of this function. Considered as a function of this adjoint, so this is an n by n matrix, n by n, well, not a Hermitian matrix, well, we have to say something about it in a moment. In general, I think just an n by n complex matrix. It's a complexification of a Hermitian matrix. And we want to minimize this on the function of this field phi, modulo the action, of course, of the gauge group G. So what you do is you diagonalize phi, you write it as, in terms of its eigenvalues, lambda 1 to lambda n. And to find a critical point, each of the eigenvalues have to be a critical point of the polynomial W. So you have this condition for all the lambda i's. And there's kind of a picture that goes along with that, is namely that you have these n eigenvalues, and they have to be distributed over the critical points of the function. So you will have some of them here, some of them here, and some of them here. And so, say, you could have n1 here, n2 here, n3 here. And it's important to always remember that this is a complex polynomial. Its coefficients are complex. So all of these critical points are saddle points. It doesn't really make sense to talk about maxima or minima. And so that means that you'll have some partition of n in terms of n1 plus nn. And that also means that if you take that particular representatives for phi, if you look at the orbits under un, there will now be a non-trivial stabilizer. And, the stabilizer will be partly broken. And so the unbroken gauge group will no longer be the full un, which you would have if phi was conjugate to the identity. But it will be now a product, un1 cross unn. Now, I will say much more about it tomorrow, but one thing that we will be interested in is now compute. So we have gauge fields for each of these factors, and Si will be the trace Wi squared in the factor Uni. So for the moment, just think now in terms of this kind of these blocks here, these gauge groups. And so in this case, we want to compute the effective action as a function of these variables S1 up to Sn and of the functions T1 up to Tn. Right, so there are two kind of objects that appear here in the final object that we are constructing. We're computing this kind of, these are kind of, if you wish, these kind of objects in the gauge field, this kind of global superfields. We have n of them in this case, and we also have the n original moduli of the field, which were the coefficients that appeared in the starting polynomial. So there are a total of two n parameters. So we want to have this function, complex function of 2n parameters. Yes? That it? Yes. Yes. Right, yes, definitely. Yeah, so this is the trace, if you wish, of W in the UNI factor. So I think of this as a gauge. We have a gauge field for UN1, we have a gauge field for UN2, and at least semi-classically we think of writing down the corresponding superfield and computing trace of the superfield squared in that particular factor. This is only a definition as weak coupling or something. Sorry? These are not gauge invariants, so you have to give a more precise definition, which I will do tomorrow.
Right, but the Ti's are ordered, but the Si's are not ordered.
Right, yes, yes. Yeah, so we'll see that they appear differently in the final answer. Yes. So let me just write down the formula, and which we'll actually prove tomorrow. So the formula is the following. This W effective is given by the following formula. I runs from 1 to n. Here are the ni, which are these objects here appearing in the partition of n. And then there's a single function, f0, that depends on the s and the t variables. dsi plus, and then here there's a very simple term where the bare coupling tau appears, Si. So the important point is that all this information is encoded in a universal function f0. So f0 is called the prepotential. And that's the thing that we want to compute. So the first claim is that there's a single function, which actually somehow doesn't know about the un, neither does it know about the ni's that appear here in this factorization. There's a single function associated to this problem, and only is given as a function of this w here, degree of the polynomial w. So, and then the question is, what is this function f? And how it's related to a matrix model, and more important, perhaps, how it's related to a Calabi-Yau manifold. So let me just write some facts. So the first fact is that this F0 is a sum of all planar diagrams that appear in a Feynman diagram expansion with some kind of the action is this W of phi. So the sum over 1 over k tk phi to the k. So this has vertices of various orders. So the planar diagram, where here is, so the sum of all diagrams, then there's, of course, the symmetry. So here's the automorphisms of the graph, say gamma. So gamma is some planar diagram, like this. And then there is some weight on the tk's, of course. So there's some factor, so there's some weight depending on the coefficients. But then there is a factor here, S, well, in general, if you have more than one S, the perturbative expansion is a little bit complicated, but suppose we have only one S, it's S to the number H, where H is the number of holes of this graph, gamma. So we have an expansion in terms of planar diagrams for F0, actually for the perturbative piece of F0. That's the piece that depends on the coupling coefficients TK. So that's the first fact. That's something I want to derive tomorrow, just using Feynman diagrams. But then the second fact, and that's actually what I now want to use, is that actually you want to sum over all these planar diagrams, and there are very powerful techniques to do this. And namely, you can do the following thing. And here we have our matrix model appearing. So there's an associated matrix model. So phi is here an n tilde cross n tilde matrix, just a single matrix. And very important that the rank of that matrix is in no way connected to the original rank in the gauge group, because you see the only place where, in this at least simple example, where the ranks of the gauge group appeared is in these coefficients over here. The function F0 was kind of independent, was kind of a universal function for this whole class of examples. So what you compute here is the following matrix integral, z, 1 divided by the volume of u n tilde, integral d phi. So this is your classical matrix model, 1 over g string, trace w of phi. So we want to consider this particular matrix model. And so I have to make a couple of remarks about this matrix model. So the first is, we want, of course, to consider this somehow in its Hof, well, that's one moment. So the first thing is that it's actually a gauged matrix model. What do I mean by that? Well, we started, so this field phi, of course, is a direct descendant from the original quantum field phi that was coupled to a gauge field. Now this, I don't want to think of this phi as a fixed matrix, but I want to think of it as a matrix modulo the action by conjugation of the group u n tilde. So that's why I kind of, but of course this measure is invariant. So the only consequence of that is that there's a canonical normalization of G, which is 1 divided by the volume of the gauge group. The second thing is that it's a holomorphic integral. And I will say something more about it in a moment when we go to eigenvalues, but it means that in general this doesn't make sense as an integral. Namely, this is a general complex polynomial. If you integrate about it, there's very bad behavior at infinity. But what you should think of, you should think of is integrating. So if you think of phi as a general n by n, so I often ignore the tilde, n by n complex matrix. And this is an, you somehow pick a cycle in this space of complex matrices. You could take, for instance, the real matrices, which is kind of the real axis. But in general, you want to pick some contour. So we have a kind of a manifold which has real dimension 2 and tilde squared. And we kind of pick some kind of a contour here of dimension n tilde squared such that this integral makes sense. That clearly includes extra choices, right? Now you have to choose somehow the behavior at infinity. But I mean, so that would be kind of the obvious kind of non-perturbative definition of that integral. But it will definitely not be canonically. It depends on various choices. If you have a polynomial of order 20, there are at least 20 branches here to pick. And you can even put your different eigenvalues on different branches. So there's lots of extra information here. But the important thing is that you want to really want to think of this as a contour integral in the space of complexified matrices. And of course, there are matrices which cannot be diagonalized, but they are somehow non-generic. So if you pick kind of a generic contour here, you can avoid them. So in that sense, that's kind of slightly different than the usual Hermitian models. And in particular, I will not at all be worried about the shape of this potential. I will treat maxima and minima equally footing. In fact, as I said already, all of them are settled points. Sorry? I think there are many choices there to make. There's not one choice. In the end, of course, we will only, for instance, actually depending on what we want to compute in the gate theory, we'll only work with the semi-classical expansion of this integral. And that's clearly independent of the choice of contour. But if you want to ask the non-perturbative completion of this, then this choice of contours comes in.
It needs to run by the critical
W. Right. Yes.
I mean, otherwise.
It's free too. Yes. The behavior of the contour at infinity, I would say, yes. Yes. Yes, in their paper about this, was this more elaborate? So that's one point, and, sorry? So again, the gate theory only sees the perturbative pieces. So one of the things I will be discussing, and I think it's very interesting, is the non-perturbative aspects of these matrix models. That actually is an aspect that doesn't, I feel, has a good physical interpretation on the gate theory side, because there are typically you compute terms genus by genus. So you're only somewhat interested in the genus expansion. But there are very interesting issues, of course, on the non-perturbative completion of the answer. No. In certain cases, somehow the answer knows more than just its definition genus by genus. Yes, please do. So in some sense, so the way to think about it is the following. So you have some quantum field theory. So you have this field phi, it's a quantum field. It has an action, which among other things has a term d4x, d2 theta. And then there's the sum tk phi to the k trace. Now you couple this to a gauge field. I will discuss that tomorrow more, what the formula is, how you couple this to a gauge field. But there's some coupling to these things which are called curly W alphas. So now you do this path integral, and you are left with something which is an integral d4x d2 theta W effective, actually, of these S. So it's really like a... Yes, one of the surprising aspects is that it depends in such a marginal way on the choice of the original gauge group. But in some sense, it's just an effective action. You can think of it at least as an effective action in this 4D quantum field theory. Yes? So, like for instance, a cutoff or something?
Well, no.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that's also something I want to discuss. But S is the only element in the chiral ring. So the other invariants that you can produce out of W are all Q bar exact. So the full answer can depend on them. But if you compute an F term like this, which depends certainly on S, but suppose it also would depend on trace W cubed, then trace W cubed would be zero when evaluated in the presence of only other chiral fields. They are zero in the chiral ring. No, not phi, sorry. No, these are all there, right? So in some sense, is that your point? Why only work up to order n plus 1 and not?
No.
You can do that, of course.
Just,
yeah, so the important thing is that if you, for instance, do SUN, the chiral ring in the gate theory, so after integrating out the metafields, is generated by S. In particular, if you compute trace W cubed or something, this is Q bar of something, so it's weakly zero. That's an important factor we'll use.
The whole dynamical answer would depend on gauge field non-locally.
Precisely.
Nothing like Wilson.
Yes, yes.
But somehow at the level of the chiral ring, it just produces the local.
Yes, certainly we just do it on R4, right? So everything somehow by definition. Yeah, I guess if you start to compactify, you know, of course, that the things get, you get very interesting dependence on these holonomies. So indeed, the theory on R3 cross S1 has very different behavior, and then precisely these Wilson loops kick in. Right, because it's by definition a field that depends on chiral fields, and it only depends on element in the chiral ring. It can only depend on things which are q-bar closed. So if you just compute this, think of it as a just general, I mean, expand, do an expansion in the fields and think of this as correlation functions in the vacua.
So a finite Wilson loop is not chiral?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about it. Well, they definitely appear when you start to, so yeah, so now you ask what happens if I make a dislocation or something. I don't know, actually. I haven't thought about it. Sorry? I don't know. Yes? I have to, do I have to?
Well, you would also observe what's on the matter spectrum.
But I integrated them out here.
So, is there a way to put them back in?
Yes, there is, of course, because, I mean, you can think of this as a function of the TKs. So taking the derivative respect to the DKs, compute all the correlation functions of the matter fields. Oh, actually, I will say something in the end of that. So if you have the answer, it's very natural to include arbitrary small perturbations by the Ts. So we get actually a generating function of an infinite set of variables.
Okay,
so I will actually discuss that. In some sense, well, there is, in the sense that I want these TKs to be finite, and but in the end, of course, you can include other ones which are kind of somehow infinitesimally small, and that would be correspond to computing correlation functions of operators. Yes.
So, do you also think that model?
Yes. Well, yes, of course. I mean, that's the statement. Yes. 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 Yes.
And so can we rest assured that in the quantum theory there's no correction to the
right, because in some sense, so again, holomorphy will tell you. So we get a holomorphic answer in terms of the T's, and then you are free to kind of actually, very important step is to look at singular Calabi-Yaus. Actually, that corresponds precisely to these double-scaled matrix models. So if you want to make connection, for instance, with all that stuff, you have to make singular limits of these T's. Yes? Sorry? The coupling to the matter field to the gauge field is not holomorphic, no. No, so that's why, yeah, so. Well, I say there are two things to do. So, I mean, there's one computation. Sorry? In the end, of course, we want to integrate over the gauge field. And sure, definitely. But this perturbative computation just makes sense as an ordinary effective action computation.
So in the ordinary effective action
computation, you do. Yes. Well, okay. The quantum fluctuation. Yes. Yes. Right. Well, yeah. So perhaps effective action is not the right word, but it's a background field. Think of it as a background field computation. Yes. Okay, so we were talking about this matrix model. So what do we want to do with the matrix model? So we want to, first, it's very interesting to compute it kind of directly, but certainly interested in doing kind of a semi-classical approximation. So what we're doing, we're looking again at the critical points of this trace W phi. And this is the same potential. So this very similar analysis as in the gate theory. However, now we have to look at a partition of this new variable and tilde, which in the end we will send to infinity. That's very important. So we will have some factorization like this. And again, we put our eigenvalues. So we have n1 tilde here, n2 tilde here, and 3 tilde here. So these are is the distribution of the eigenvalues of our matrix phi. So we write phi again as u lambda 1 up to lambda and tilde u inverse. And now what we want to do is we want to look at the want to take a limit. So we take a limit here, the large n limit, so the hoofd limit. Will be now the following limit. We have our variable g string that appears here in front of the action, which you should think of as h bar. In fact, this connection with quantum mechanics, I really want to stress, because that will be part of kind of the punchline of these lectures, that you really want to think of this as being directly connected to quantum mechanics. So the hoof limit we will take is to take this variable to zero, and not only send the rank of the matrix to zero, but kind of these relative factors here, the so-called filling fractions, and I tilde also to infinity. And this gives a set of finite variables, namely ni tilde h bar, and these we will call si. And again, to put a certain idea in your head, think of these ni's as quantum numbers of a quantum system. So these are kind of like the classical variables that you keep fixed. So that's really somehow the semi-classical limit also in the usual sense. And so then we know that just using Feynman diagrams, there's a well-defined asymptotic expansion of this matrix integral that does not depend on any of the choices of contours. So the matrix model Z has now a well-defined semi-classical expansion around these critical points labeled by the variables S1 up to Sn of the form exponent sum over the genus of the diagrams. Then there's g string to the 2g minus 2. And then there's an fg that depends on the positions on the saddle points around which we are doing the expansion. And of course, around depends on these variables t1, tn that parameterize the potential. So the important thing is that the space of critical points now becomes a kind of a smooth moduli space. So the si are parameters. So they parameterize kind of the moduli space of critical points. In fact, if you work at finite n, it's important to realize that these SIs are not smooth variables, but they are quantized, right? So in some sense, the finite g, so finite n, which means finite g string, so the somehow finite g string, these SIs aren't really be thought of as continuous variables. The T's are, but the S's are kind of quantized. But if you take this kind of large n limits, then the SIs become smooth, they become some kind of real variables. And we also find that the answers are actually holomorphic in the SIs. So in some sense, we want to extend them as being complex variables. That's part of the kind of magic that appears. So this is the setup of the problem. As average of? So we work at fixed rank, right? So this is the this is just the definition of the SIs.
Yeah.
No. No. It's very important. I could do this, but I'm here in this matrix model. I work with fixed rank. Yes. Yes. Precisely. Yes. Well, okay. This is an interesting question, and it will come back at the end because it will be related to the fact that I will actually try to link this with the kind of Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. And then I actually will see that, in general, you cannot do that on all orbits, so you have to make some choice. And what you do, your prescription working with the chemical potential somehow kind of just a canonical transformation on that picture. So I'll come back to that. Yes, I will discuss it.
Isn't that sort of a perturbative versus non-perturbative issue?
Yes. So in some sense, non-perturbatively, I guess you would claim that these, well, in the end, would turn out to the shape of the Calabi-Yau is quantized. So how do you solve this matrix model in this limits? Oh, let me make one more remark, which actually I think I will just carry through because it will also come back, I hope, is that it's very natural to do this for supermatrices, which I think is particularly important for those of you interested in studying D-brains on Calabi-Yau manifolds, because it includes, it's basically working with D-brains and anti-D-brains. So if you kind of work with DB bar brains. So if you can just make phi, so instead of working with a matrix ensemble for the gauge group un tilde, you can kind of generalize this to a supermatrix, un plus, un minus, and write down a supermatrix model where the action now is the supertrace of this W of phi. And if you do that, you will actually see that basically everything goes through as in the case for an ordinary matrix model, with one kind of major exception. So the point is that if you draw your Feynman diagrams, the usual kind of ribbon diagram or large N expansion philosophy will associate a factor of trace of 1, which is kind of N, for every whole. But of course, if you work with a supermatrix, it's supertrace of 1. Which is by definition n plus minus n minus. So actually the statement is that if you do naively the supermatrix model, it will be equivalent to an ordinary matrix model where n tilde is just n plus minus n minus. But there are certain kind of advantages working with the supermatrix model, so at some point I will come back to that. So let me now, for the meantime, just look, describe for you the solution of the model. So this is something that, well, David, to some extent, already did a few weeks ago. But I just go through it and try to write the solution as geometric as possible. So the first thing is that you go to eigenvalues. So we have phi, and we diagonalize it in terms of the eigenvalues, lambda 1 to lambda n tilde. And write down the matrix model in terms of the eigenvalues. So you can do this very easily. You get a product of the eigenvalues. Then you get a measure factor from reducing, basically integrating out this u variable, which is the famous van der Monde determinant. So you get the product I less than j, lambda I minus lambda j squared. And then you get just the action evaluated for the eigenvalues. So this is the expression we will work with. And so how you can look at the critical points of this action. So one thing, of course, is to write this whole thing as an effective action of the eigenvalues. So you write some S effective of the eigenvalues, lambda 1 to lambda n. Where the effective action is given by exponentiating this log of this this van der Monde, which gives a log. So you have an S effective, which is just sum of the lambda i's minus in 2g string sum of I less than j log lambda I minus lambda j. And then you can look at the critical points of this action to kind of analyze the asymptotic expansion. So at the settle point, you have W prime of lambda I is 2g string sum over j not equal to I 1 over lambda I minus lambda j. Sorry? Oh, good, yes. So how, what is kind of the best way, in some sense, to look at this problem? So what I really like, and it actually will come back, this point of view, when we study brains in this background, is to kind of put one extra eigenvalue, so-called probe eigenvalue. That's a non-dynamical eigenvalue, say lambda n plus 1, call that X, and just look at the effective action of S. Well, in the solution of the saddle point equations for the other n eigenvalues, lambda I, and then you get a nice equation, namely you get the following equation. You get a variable y of x, which is the derivative of this effective action with respect to x. And it has two terms. It has, of course, the classical term w prime of x. And it has a quantum term, minus 2g string. Why do I have a minus sign here? Well, I think I should plus. Sum over x minus lambda I. So there are two terms here, the classical term and the quantum, the one-loop term over here. Now, one thing that appears here is the resolvent, so let me give it a name. There's the resolvent of the matrix model omega of x, which is 1 over n trace of x minus phi. So it's 1 over n and tilde, sum over x minus lambda I. And if you wish, you can write y as w prime of x plus 2 times, well, g string n tilde times omega x. For this thing here, I will call s. It's the sum of the si's. It's the overall at hoofd parameter. Now, one small observation. Well, yes. So let's work with this model. So how do you kind of solve this model now? Well, so this is a nice geometric way to look at this solution. So we're drawing some pictures. So I first draw the picture at g string equal to 0. So if you just ignore the quantum corrections at all, what's going on? Well, we're just looking at the critical point of this action. So the critical point here is, so you can ignore this term altogether. So at g string equal to 0, we have the equation y is w prime of x. In fact, if you would have worked with a supermatrix, let us see, I'm not actually going through the whole derivation with the supermatrix, but if you had done this, so supermatrix, you would have two kinds of eigenvalues, basically positive and negative negatively charged eigenvalues, and then the equation would be y is plus or minus w prime of x. Because you can think of this as the, this is just the, there's the force on a particle in a potential, a w prime, w, and of course in general the force will be the charge times the potential. So there's a natural sign here that appears if you work with the supermatrix model. So that is a little bit of a motivation to write down the following equation, y squared is w prime x squared. So we'll draw a picture for that. So these are the pictures that go along with it. So this is the x-plane. In the x-plane, you will have the critical points of the potential, a1 up to an. And in the classical limit, all the eigenvalues are sitting here. So you have n1 tilde eigenvalue sitting here, and n tilde eigenvalue sitting here. And the corresponding algebraic equation that goes along with it is this equation, y squared is w prime squared. So if w is something like this, like a quartic potential, that equation would look something like this. Would have two branches. This is the branch y is w prime, and this is the branch y is minus w prime. And this is the picture in the xy plane. And what you see is that you get, if you wish, an algebraic curve, namely this function of two polynomial in two variables, y and x, that has double points here. So this is a singular curve, and if you draw it as a Riemann surface, it will look like this, where it has these nodal points over here. So this is just, if you wish, a natural picture that goes along with this equation, y is plus or minus w prime of x. But of course, that's somehow the classical picture. So what is kind of the But what is the picture if you introduce the finite, well, the one loop integrating out essentially these angular variables? So claim, and it's actually a very short derivation, I will do it in a moment, there's a very, very famous fact, which is called the loop equation. So if h of g string, which was h bar, is not equal to zero, but of course always in this kind of that Hoeft limit, but so we take this kind of this limit where this goes to infinity, then you can solve for y, and y satisfies the following equation, y squared is w prime x squared, plus a function f of x, which is a polynomial of degree n minus 1. So this is a polynomial of degree n minus 1. And so it will depend on certain coefficients, so I will often write f of x as some bk x to the k, k running from 0 to n minus 1. And so we have n new variables, and the statement is that the bk's are in one-to-one correspondent with the variable sk's that in the end we want to write down the answer into. So we're looking for a function, remember, we're looking for a function that depends on the choice of w and n extra variables. And I'm claiming these n extra variables are precisely encoded in this extra polynomial that you call the quantum correction. So there's a nice picture that you can draw of this. So I'll give the derivation of this in a moment, it's just basically one line. But it's a nice picture to draw of this, because if you now draw that equation, what happens, of course, is that these that curve over there gets replaced, so you get something which now looks like this. So this is the graph of the relation between y and x. And what has happened, of course, if you think about it, we started with a curve. So in general, this will be a so-called hyperelliptic curve. We have y squared, this w prime squared plus f, is some polynomial of degree 2n in x. And in fact, since we have n variables here and n variables here, there are altogether 2n variables, which is enough to have this, we can just write this in general form. So x minus alpha I, x minus beta I runs from 1 to n. But alpha I and beta I are now the kind of the endpoints. Well, they will now parameterize branch cuts. So there are branch cuts now here, which are just kind of the smoothings out of the original double point. So if f goes to 0, of course, this alpha I, beta I, just go to the critical points, ai. So we have branch cuts instead of double points, and now we have a nice smooth Riemann surface, which looks like this. So the usual way in which this is argued, I mean, there's, of course, a very nice picture that goes along with the matrix model. So in the matrix model, we started with this potential. We had all these eigenvalues sitting here at the critical points of the potential. But remember, putting in the g-string corrections was just including this interaction among the eigenvalues, so including these van der Monde determinants in the matrix integral, which gave this logarithmic Coulomb potential. And then there's the usual thing, this is a picture that David also sketched. Kind of these eigenvalues start to behave like fermions, and they kind of fill up the potential well. And so if you look at the picture, if you look at the eigenvalue distribution, so an important ingredient of this is the distribution of the eigenvalues. So we have a spectrum. So the eigenvalue density, rho of x, which is 1 over n tilde, the sum over the delta functions of x minus lambda I, this becomes a smooth function, and so it becomes actually something, well, actually, which you can draw very nice in this picture over here. So the eigenvalues will now be distributed along these branch cuts with a certain profile. So there's a very nice way in which you can think of this kind of condensation of eigenvalues as opening up the Riemann surface. So there's a very direct connection between the geometry of the Riemann surface and the distribution of the eigenvalues at this critical point. So how do you prove this relation? So that actually is very easy. Let me just sketch it for those of you who haven't seen this. You start with this resolvent, omega of x, you square it, and that's actually something like n tilde squared, the sum over 1 over x minus lambda I squared. And then you observe, if you just multiply these two factors, well, this is something which has a simple pole at each of the positions of the eigenvalues. So if you square the thing, you either have two simple poles or a double pole. And but the double poles appear in some sense on the diagonal. There are only n of them, while there are n squared terms where there are two different eigenvalues. So in the large n limits, you can ignore the double poles and write this as a sum, 1 over n squared, only of the cases where the two poles are different. And then you can actually write it as 2 times x minus lambda I minus lambda j. So these are just the terms where you have single poles. And then you look at this and you recognize part of the saddle point equation, namely, which said that for each of these eigenvalues, there was here 2g string lambda I minus lambda j. So you can replace this thing here with this much more simpler expression, which actually is, if you throw in everything, it's 1 over n tilde g string, the sum over I minus w prime of lambda I over lambda I minus lambda, sorry, x minus lambda I. So now the potential appears. And then the final step is, what you do is you write this as plus w prime of x minus w prime of x. And now you can see there are two terms appearing. One term, which is this one, that's easy. That has a very simple dependence on the lambda I. It's actually just a resolvent, again, multiplied by w prime of x. That's the first, that's this last term. And there's a coefficient here, which turned out to be 1 over g string n tilde. And then there's a second term. And the, but the second term, it has a very nice analytic structure. So the second term, the following object appears. One over n tilde, sum over I, w prime x minus w prime lambda I over x minus lambda I. And this actually is a polynomial, because this is a polynomial of degree n, but you see it has one root, which is x is lambda I. So this is actually polynomial, whatever it is, it's a polynomial of degree n minus 1. So this is by definition the polynomial f n minus 1, up to a factor of, I think, yes, well, perhaps a factor of 4. Anyhow, this is where the polynomial appears. And you see, this thing is very sensitive of how the eigenvalues are distributed. If you, at the kind of small fluctuation expansion, what is this? Well, this is would be the sum of the number of eigenvalues at the ith critical point times the second derivative at the critical point ai. Right? So this in first approximation, you see that this actually depends precisely on how the eigenvalues are distributed. And so what I'm doing here. Lambda I. Yeah. Okay. So that's the zeroth order term, and then there are terms order x. Sorry. There's an s here. So the s, remember, was this g string times n tilde. But that's a finite number. So that's just part of the And in some sense, this tells you why it's kind of a quantum correction. So that, in that sense, you easily derive this algebraic equation. So let me now finish the solution of the model. So what did we learn? We learned that just from the matrix model, the way I want to think about this matrix model is that two things. So we get an algebraic curve, which in this case was a very simple elliptic curve, hyperelliptic curve. But also we have a very natural object on it, namely there's a meromorphic one-form, which is y dx. But remember, this, I want to think of this as the variation of the effect of action of this probe eigenvalue in the system. So I can add one more eigenvalue, vary it, so there's a natural one-form. Actually, it's holomorphic on this kind of non-compact Riemann surface, but it has a pole at infinity, because clearly we know that this y had this form. I remind you of w, well, let me just even spell it out. It was some tk x to the k, where this now runs from k equals 1 to n plus 1, plus kind of this n tilde g string, well, g string times the resultant. So particularly, you can see here that it has its leading behavior of this term will be a term g string n tilde times 1 over x plus then order 1 over x squared. So there's this very specific one form that you get. So that's, I think, important to keep in mind. You get the geometry out and you get the one form out. So what is the relation of the one form to the solution of the matrix model? Well, so this is encoded, and this was for me a big surprise when we found it. So this is encoded in relations which are called special geometry. So there are the following geometrical objects. So let me sketch again the Riemann surface. So this is the Riemann surface we got out just from the loop equation. And that Riemann surface has non-trivial cycles. So let me give them a name. So there are A cycles, which are the cycles that went around the branch cuts. And then there are dual cycles, B cycles, which in some sense go like from infinity to infinity. So this is the picture in the Riemann surface. So it's perhaps also good to draw this picture in the x-plane. So remember, this Riemann surface is kind of two copies of the x-plane glued together on branch cuts. Right? So there are these branch cuts here. And, well, they're also here downstairs. And they're kind of connected with little tubes. And in particular, if you wish, there's one point here at infinity. Well, so we have this picture, and here downstairs is the x-plane. Perhaps that's a better picture, where here the branch curves are. And there's a point here at infinity. And this point at infinity has two positions here, kind of plus, infinity plus, and infinity minus. So there are two points, which are these two points here and here. And so now we can draw these contours also here. So, for instance, the period A1 is something that goes around the first branch cut, and B1 is something that I think is better drawn over here, like it goes like this, goes in, and goes out like this. But of course, in some sense here, it looks like it goes in and out again, but it goes through the branch cut. So the moment it goes through, it's on the second sheet. So and now you can compute the periods. So you get this Riemann surface, you get a one form. It's natural to compute the periods of the one form. In particular, you have these beautiful relations. If you compute the periods of y dx around the A cycle, then it's very important to remember that in the original definition, say at finite n, y had a simple pole at the position of each of the eigenvalues. In fact, with residue g string. So if you integrate it around the A cycle here, you get a factor g string for each of the eigenvalues. So this is just measuring the number of eigenvalues. So this is g string times the number of eigenvalues which were at the ith critical point and which produces the length of the branch cut. So this is the thing Si. And again, I remind you already a little bit, so think in these pictures really why, think of it as somehow the momentum conjugate to x, and then this is just kind of Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization, because it's telling you that this orbit is not fixed, but it's quantized in units of h-bar in some sense. So here is the relation, so this gives you in particular the relation between the coefficients bk that appeared in this polynomial f here. These were the coefficients of f, and it relates them to the variables sk. And to, for instance, Ezra, your remark about the symmetry of the sks is kind of obvious here. The bks are ordered, but these sks are in some sense the symmetric polynomials in the bks. So they're just given by this holonomy. So that's the first remark. And then the second remark is that you really have to make use now of the fact that there's not any meromorphic one form, but it's a meromorphic one form that's obtained by variation of this effective action of a single eigenvalue in the presence of these n other eigenvalues. So the last remark is that if you integrate around the B cycle, so how do we think about the integral around the B cycle? Well, what are you doing? Well, it's better perhaps to first think of the integral over half of the B cycle, where you take an integral from infinity to the branch cut. Actually, because you go on the other sheet where y is related with a minus sign, you're just computing twice the integral from infinity. So this is somehow twice the integral from the critical point ai to infinity of y dx. But y dx is just a variation of the effective action of x. So what this is just doing, it's kind of computing, if you wish, the effect of adding one more eigenvalue, actually taking out, in this case, one eigenvalue of the system. So we are changing, we are seeing here the response of the system by removing one eigenvalue. In fact, because of the factor of g, so this is somehow the variation of the free energy with respect to the number of eigenvalues ni. But if you look carefully, there are various facts of g string. In fact, there's a natural factor of g string that goes here. The thing appearing in the exponent was s effective divided by g string. So this actually is d f0 dsi. So these two relations, so relation here and over there, so these are the relations of special geometry. And so we can think of this now in the following way. So this I really think of the following way. We have this curve, y squared plus w prime squared plus f. It's a general algebraic curve. I put two n variables, the t's which are sitting inside here, and the s's that sit inside here. But now you can look at the variation only with respect to the s. So there's a natural distinction in the 2n moduli, in n kind of fixed moduli, and n which are kind of, some sense dynamical, or you can kind of vary about them. And now, tomorrow, or I think I will explain better the relation to Calabi-Yau's threefolds, and then we see actually that there's a natural distinction between these two in the sense that these are so-called normalizable moduli. The typical things that in the end you want to integrate over, at least minimize them. And these are the non-normalizable moduli. So we will do that tomorrow, but let me finish by making one last remark. So point is, if you take multi-matrix models, in particular matrix models say phi 1 up to phi p, let's call it p minus 1. this appropriate action, then you get curves which are of the form y to the p is some polynomial p of x. So it's natural to get, instead of two-fold covers, to get p-fold covers. And so we get hyperelliptic or two-fold covers for the case of one model, but it's easy to do this. Sorry? So this is the, you take the quiver action for A, I guess, P minus 2. All right, so for instance, for the two matrix model, you have two adjoints, phi 1 and phi 2, and then you have bifundamentals going between them. It's a matrix chain, yes.
So it's not
closed. It's not closed. No, sorry, I'm drawing it wrong, yes.
Just a two-dimensional.
This is, sorry? Yes, you put bifundamentals. Yes, you put bifundamentals here. Yeah, so there's a natural way to write these matrix models for actually arbitrary ADE diagrams work very nicely, where this diagonalization with eigenvalues works exactly the same thing. Yes. Precisely. Yeah. So in general, you would have a chain like this. Right. Yes. So you would have a, for instance, yeah, you would have a potential, well, with alternating signs. But for instance, in the two matrix model, no, you can have a congested, no, you can have arbitrary potentials in each of the nodes, in principle. Sorry? Yes, I think so. A good example is the two matrix model, where you get natural two potentials. Yes, I think I'm saying this correctly. Yes. But let me just check on this. So this is the first point. The second point I want to make is that you can take so-called double scaling limits, and you can work kind of very hard to do this in terms of the matrix model, but you can. It's much nicer to do this immediately in terms of the geometry. Because you give me the matrix model, I get this geometry out. And for instance, in this case, I get a general hyperelliptic curve. And it has two n parameters, which are encoded as in t's and the s's. So by kind of tuning the potential w and tuning the critical points, the distribution of the eigenvalues over the critical points, I can make any polynomial I want to. In particular, you can make a lot. So for instance, in this case, you can take y squared to be, for instance, something like x to the 2n plus 1. So what does this correspond to? Well, this corresponds to the following thing. You have your branch cut. You take one branch cut. All the other ones are double points. So they have a double pole. And you all send them here. So just by kind of tuning all the branch cuts, you can make any singularity you want. And by doing this with matrix models, you can write general things like y squared, y to the cube plus stuff. So this actually, these geometry, so I want to do this double scaling limit entirely in terms of the geometry. So these correspond to what in the old days were PQ minimal models. Coupled to gravity. But, so I could work very hard to do this directly in the matrix model, but I prefer to do it from now on just in terms of the geometry. Because the geometry encodes the matrix model, at least the planar part of it. So we'll have to discuss how it encodes the non-planar part. No, you can. So you can get the 2, 2n plus 1 models out. Sure, sure, yes, of course. Yes, yes, right, yes. So you use this kind of this quiver matrix model.
You could get PQ out of the two matrix.
Yeah, but that's a different matrix model. So I will also discuss, so that was the matrix model with two matrices, say X and Y with, you can write this matrix model, WX1 plus W2Y. It's not the quiver matrix model, And actually, you can get actually basically any algebraic curve out of this. And I will discuss this when I discuss the sequence one model. Yes. No. So it's definitely true, of course, that this is how multicritical behavior was discovered. But I want to kind of emphasize this curve because, in the end, I want to argue that the full genus expansion of this thing is obtained by somehow making this into a quantum object. So at some point, I will look at, for instance, at this Hamiltonian with y will become ddx.
Full genus expansion of the Likert's model.
Yes.
Defined by geometry.
Yes. No, actually, we will go both directions. We will go both directions. So I want to, at some point, because what I want to do, of course, I mean, the overall aim here is to study these geometries, forgetting that they come from matrix models, because the category of these geometries is much bigger than the one of matrix models. And there are many Calabi-Yau manifolds that don't know how to realize a matrix model. So somehow I want to try to formulate it entirely in kind of geometrical means. That's kind of my overall aim. So you will have just, it's the usual thing. So you'll have adjoints. So the general thing is you have some wi of ad, and then you'll have qi j phi I q tilde j. Yeah, things like that. Yes, yes.
Right. Just linear in the phi i's or arbitrary?
They are linear in the phi i's here, but here, of course, they can arbitrary polynomials.
Okay.
Yes.
But in principle, arbitrary polynomials.
Yes, but so the thing that was observed, and which we also observed, is that this is precisely the kind of coupling which leads to very simple description in terms of the eigenvalues. In fact, the eigenvalues, instead of having like a charge, they are now charged with an element in the Lie algebra of ADE. So you get kind of this Coulomb gas model with some sense, higher dimensional charge lattice. The charge lattice is precisely the lattice, the root lattice of the corresponding Lie algebra. So there's a nice observation that precisely these kind of quiver models are the ones which lead themselves to this technique of going to eigenvalues very nicely and solving it as a Coulomb gas model. Well, in the end, I will write down some quantum mechanics, and then I can take the WKB limit, and that will correspond to this genus zero part.
Okay, so that's
yes, yes. Right. No, but there's much more to it. Yes.
Is there any meaning to derivatives of f with respect to the variables t?
Of course. Yeah. So I should have said that. That if you want to compute, df0, ddk's, these are just the expectation values of trace phi to the k in the matrix model, which are closely related to the ones in the gate theory, but they're not precisely these ones. But this is in the matrix model, and this will be trace w squared phi to the k in the gate theory. So in the end, you want to think of probably these f0s as dependent on an infinite set of couplings tk. But it's very much like in this with these non-critical strings. You want to think of the leading behavior, leading coefficient determines kind of the universality class, because it's the genus of the Riemann surface. But then, of course, you can think of these other t's as infinitesimal. So in some sense, even if you only take a cubic potential, there's still an infinite set of operators whose expectation values you can compute. So formally, you get a solution f0 that depends, say, on some fixed, say, background values of the TK, you take a finite of them to be non-zero, and then you add kind of some variations to them, and these are, you think of them as an formal asymptotic expansions in these small small variables. Sorry? But I never take them finite. So I only think, the moment you give an eigenvalue distribution, I can compute all the moments of the eigenvalue distribution. That's just a statement.
Yeah, but you need to
formally give it No. I just think of this as a formal expansion, as we did for non-critical strings.
Yeah, probably.
So that makes sense.
You may not be able to
That, I think there's no problem there. Sure, but as long as I do this in expansion in the small variables, the convergence is determined by the large values are completely determined by the t-bars. Well, we should discuss this, I guess, in private.
Factorization, like cluster decomposition, you're only ever going to compute one point function.
Sure. Sure, at large n, but at finite n, not, of course. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Okay, thank you.